Good afternoon. Welcome to Tate Modern. I'm Gabriela Salgado, Curator of Public Programs, and I'm delighted to introduce our speaker today, Dennis Oppenheim, who very generously came a very long way to be with us today. This is the first event of a series, second season, that we are doing in partnership with Art Monthly, and Patricia Vickers is next to me to represent Art Monthly. This is, as you know, something we've been running for a while. Last year, we did a very, very good series of events, nearly once a month, with prominent artists and writers, critics in conversation. The format remains the same. We will be doing a series of events, starting today with Dennis and going into the year. The leaflets on your chairs list all the events that are coming up. And just to say thank you very much for coming. If you can, please switch off your phones, because we are webcasting this event. It would be also very useful if you wait for the microphone to come to us, to you, when asking questions because of the webcasting. And thank you very much, Lisa Lefebvre, who will be in conversation with Dennis, and Dennis, for being here again. Thank you.
Thank you, Gabriela, and thank you for coming this afternoon. As Gabriela said, it's the second series, and we're very proud to launch it with Dennis Oppenheim, someone I've always wanted to meet, and whose work I've been very familiar with for years. His work spans everything from performance to installation, but recently he's been making public art, which doesn't actually go against his principles. It still remains controversial, and as one critic recently put it, he turns the audience from viewers to users, not interactive in that sort of press button way, but genuine use. And we're very proud to have him talking today to Lisa Lefebvre, who has credit for bringing Dennis Oppenheim over once before, and his work should be shown more in this country. We'll at least learn something about it from both of them today. Lisa's a regular contributor to Art Monthly. She's also curator at the National Maritime Museum and teaches on the Goldsmiths curating course. Dennis, as I say, really needs very little introduction from me, so let's not waste time and get straight on. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Patricia. As you can probably hear already, I've sort of lost my voice, so if you can't hear me, wave your hand, and you have to excuse me if I start coughing halfway through. It's just the way it is today. So really, to echo Patricia's words, it does feel such a kind of honor and a pleasure to get to talk to Dennis for 50 minutes or so. We're going to talk for a bit, and then we'll open up to see if anyone's got any questions or points and so on. But I think just to start talking, one of the things that really struck me, Dennis, in thinking about talking today is the amount of interviews that you've done throughout all of your practice. It seems that in every publication, in every connection with any exhibition or commission that you do, this sense of a conversation or a dialogue around it is really important. I mean, do you see that as being something that is very connected to your...
I don't remember all these interviews, but I know that I prefer interviews with artists. Yeah, I prefer reading them, so I always look for them. But I guess I don't remember all these interviews that I've done. I don't know why.
Well, there's endless ones, and one of the things that I think pretty much every single interview or conversation starts with is a reflection on the fact that it's impossible to characterize your artistic practice as something that could be described as a signature style. And there's always a real temptation, I think, in conversations with artists to try and reduce it down to something that fits within language. And it seems that throughout all of your practice, there's this incredible defiance to never have a signature style and never to have it explained away. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about your kind of sense of constantly shifting your registers of operation.
Well, I'm not sure if one would admit that they're in control here necessarily. I think what could be the case is individuals that do have a signature style that do continue on a certain level or certain pathway for a long period of time, perhaps their entire career, are able to do it. Mm-hmm. And those of us who may have tried to stay with a certain idea, a certain strand, continue it, repeat it, extend it, elongate it, may have found it difficult or impossible. Mm. So I think that I would probably fall into that category. I have tried to sustain interest in certain things long enough to have a consistency, and for some reason I've always found it difficult or impossible. And so if that's the case, one has to invent excuses for what occurs then, which is a sort of a seeming dislocation, rambling, short attention span, almost suggesting to some that you may not have come up with anything yet that you feel is important enough to sustain. It plays havoc with your career because the support system is usually looking for evidence of a certain sort of discovery on the part of the artist, and they equate this discovery with the ability to keep doing it. But you know, if you look closely at the landscape in which consistency evolves, one could say that once you discover something, repeating it is not necessarily going to extend it. And I think that there's some sort of catalytic device that occurs when I land on something that has a certain potential, like land art. Land art, as a area to sort of find yourself involved with, seemed to be of such substantial substance that you could continue it the rest of your life. So there's a mechanism in you that short circuits it. You purposely bring it to a close so that you can move on.
And that seems to be something that, for me, is one of the very wonderful things within your artistic practice, is that you're constantly asking questions, but not in a kind of abstract, undefinable way. It's asking questions in order to move towards an answer, but as soon as that answer comes into sight, that's the moment when you seem to shift to a different register of practice. So you're talking then about this early period when your work has been categorized, and I kind of want to emphasize it has been categorized rather than is, as land art or earth art. And you were mentioning earlier that that last week you took part in a symposium that was looking back at one very particular exhibition called the Earth Art Show. So the 40-year anniversary of it, and the Earth Art Show was organized by Willoughby Sharp, and it brought together a number of artists, and kind of retrospectively it becomes seen as the moment this became a recognizable tendency within practice. And I'm kind of intrigued to know how it feels to talk about this work that's nearly four decades old, even over four decades old.
Well, you know, earth art, body art, falling under the equation of conceptual art, has a extraordinary long appearance in the art scene. I don't think I know of a movement that has permeated as much as conceptual art. It seems to still be among us. And it is 40 years old, at least. So. I mean, I was talking to some students recently, and they kept bringing up conceptual art, and I said, well, God, why are we talking about a thing that's 40 years old? Let's talk about the present. But 40 years ago, most of the people in the Land Art Show Earth Art Show were unknown. So it's a point where you come out of oblivion into visibility. And so that early period is always extremely important for anyone who you know experiences it. You know, in talking about the evolutionary vicissitudes involved in a career, if you're always moving from one place to another, you can find yourself going from radical art, a truly new window, back into areas that are more conventional.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what I would have to bring into conversation is the fact that land art was a relatively radical departure from making objects. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really did usher in this whole state of dematerialization. And art, I mean, it's sort of paradoxical because it was taking its clues from minimalism and it was trying to become so minimal that you kind of excluded the substance from the work, and that sort of opened the doors to the outside world. It's almost like music sort of trying to do away with sound. So it was extremely adventurous to go out in that pathway. And a lot of the work I'm doing now, particularly the public art, you would have to say is comparatively conventional.
Mm. Mm.
And that's sort of uncomfortable because you want to believe that there's some sort of authentic extrapolation from one period to the next that moves in some sort of direction. Unfolding but yet expanding. And I mean, if you trace some of these pieces from one to the next, you see instead a kind of occasionally moving backwards into a region that has almost been rejected by the work prior to it. So it is convoluted and perverse.
Mm, I think so. And I think it's important to think about the work that you're doing, that you're terming public art, there's in terms that are absolutely informed by where it has come in relation to your practice. And I find that there's something that is actually quite radical in this public art, because it's as if this phase of your work is taking an extreme risk in its pretense of conventionality. And this risk-taking really characterizes, again, all of your practice, from what is defined the land art to the body art to the museum-based fireworks series I want to come on to talk about in a moment. But I personally find there's something incredibly risky about this public art in its playing out of something that appears to be conventional. I mean, it's something that personally I've wrestled a lot with your work about. What do I think about this public art? And I think its shock and its contrariness has an incredible power. But for me, that this also feeds into something that right from your earliest work you've investigated, which is the systems of art. And it seems to me, Dennis, that you're constantly pushing at the idea of a comfort zone. It could be a comfort zone for you as an artist, for, to use Patricia's term, the user of your work, so the person who's receiving it or looking at it, but also for the gallery structures as well. And there's a slide, I think it's about to come up, that is really looking at, I guess we would call it today, the kind of institutional situations of art. So there's a series of works called Gallery Structure and Gallery Transplant. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about those works, because they're not written about so much, but to me they're really, really important pieces.
Well, it goes way back. In fact, it goes before works were executed out on the land. There was a period in 67 when I made proposals, which were all sort of extrapolated from minimal art and dealt with negative negative space. I mean, it's funny, like the summer of 1968, when a lot of this outdoor work was just beginning to get generated by Robert Smithson and Heiser and so on and so forth, we call that the summer of the hole in the ground, because there seemed to be so much wrapped up in the idea of a hole, and it seemed to carry this sort of idea of minimalism further, because if you dig a hole, you're creating a kind of question about the where does it end, and the supposition then was that it activated the periphery, so that created this whole horizontal situation, and that's probably one of the major exponents of this art, is the fact that it counted the verticality of sculpture with a horizontal activation, and that just opened up the floodgates. Now, the gallery transplants, which were done in 69, is an indication of the fact that you never forget where you came from. And even though you open the doors and you're outside, you're working in real time, you're working in deserts, you're working on the land, and you've forgotten the gallery, you don't really forget it. So you want to attack it. You know, this art was not necessarily a political gesture to create a lack of credibility in the support system or the museums and galleries. That was a exponent of the work. It wasn't a direct objective, but in doing it, one constantly sort of wanted to refer back to the gallery and museum. So the transplants were simply taking the floor plans of these spaces and putting them outdoors.
So. And then it seems kind of from that early period, from the kind of 67, 68 period, you then utilize other structures within a gallery. So utilizing lectures, which is another kind of, well, we're doing one here, a staple element of what the kind of processes of art is. And also with the work Recall as well, you're looking at the system of the art school. So these systems, it seems to me that you're not proposing them in terms of necessarily attacking them or trying to neutralize them. I think that's a very kind of mythical, romantic reading of them. It's more that you're highlighting the existence of these systems and proposing a question of, well, what do you do with these systems?
It's... I mean, if you work the way that I do, where your guard is down sometimes, you aren't necessarily in possession of a certain viewpoint that is going to sustain your operation and lead you into it, you can become captive to certain impulses. And in making art in the mid-70s, it seemed that as you directed it towards an outside entity, you became more captivated in the mechanism that you were engaging in developing the art. In other words, the kind of psychological, physiological, philosophical matrix that made up the pathways that you were engaging to attack or pursue certain things became in themselves where you wanted the art to be directed to. So you kind of cannibalized your methodology, and that became what you wanted to illustrate or to objectify. So the 70s, and it lasted for 4 or 5 years, most of that work had this autobiographical element, where it was surreptitiously uncovering one's own mechanism, and it was very seductive. You know, sometimes the stuff you do is what's seducing you, and sometimes the seduction is intellectual, Sometimes it's a combination of intuitive and intellectual things combined. But when I remember being truly mystified more than by the process that I was using, and not sure what this process was or what it looked like, or if you could even shed any light upon this in any visual way, but simply finding that it's far more deserving of a place to penetrate than anything outside was really quite a realization to sense that happening to you.
And it also seems that's very, very important in this kind of this kind of early moment of, in terms of your kind of wider artistic practice, you never seem to have this romanticized idea of not documenting what you were doing. Documentation seems really, really important at this moment. So not, and I'm not sure if I'm correct here, but it seems that it wasn't important for you to take photographs and then show them in the gallery. The documentation was just more a trace of what had happened rather than being a substitute or a surrogate for the artwork itself.
Yeah, well, you know, there was a lot of suspicion about the early use of photography, particularly by individuals who were claiming to be sculptors. I mean, if you're doing land art, for instance, and relying on photography. However, it's strange that photography became such a primary art form, because before the mid-60s, photography was a relatively minor art form. And then since it dovetailed into conceptual art, it became major. In fact, it's probably on the same strata as painting. And that came forth through this usage. That's just another kind of byproduct of the whole engagement.
That's something I wanted to come back to, sort of the way that your work seemed to shift from throughout the 1970s was your engagement with risk. So there's some very particular works where you're putting yourself in a position of risk. So there's one work that's called Stone Circle Fear, where basically you stand in a circle and someone throws rocks at you, which seems the craziest thing to do ever. But it's a work that is an event and also is a film. But the risk then, through the 1970s, started to be pulled into what you've described as being machines that came into the gallery space, that then later developed into what you call the fireworks series. But I wanted to talk maybe more abstractly about your interest in this quite literal, not metaphorical, risk that you're working with so often.
Well, it seemed to show itself overtly in body art. It seemed that in going along the journey of body art as it materialized as